I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. A very fine book that's out now is Welcome to the Departure Lounge, Adventures in Mothering Mother. Its author, Meg Federico, joins me now. She tells a compelling story in this book. It's a frank account of her mother, Addie's, decline. She'd recently remarried a fellow named Walter. They drink, and she's become frailer. He's a bit loud and gruff, if not abusive. She can't see, and the two of them need around-the-clock care. Meg Federico regularly writes in the National Post. She's appeared in the Globe and Mail and on CBC Radio. She lives in Halifax, where she traveled regularly from to look in on her mom in New Jersey. The book is often funny. It is also moving and poignant. It's just a great read, especially for the generation of boomers who will have to look after their parents in due course. The book is published by Doubleday and retails for $29.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Meg Federico. Good morning, Ms. Federico.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This is your first book, is it?
Yes, it is my first book.
And it's also been published in the States, is that correct?
Yep, that's right, by Random House.
That must be a great thrill for a first-time author to get published here and there.
Well, I have to tell you, it was totally shocking because I never really thought that this book would, you know, find as great a big a publisher as Random House. I thought maybe it would get picked up by a smaller press, or I'd put it up on the internet on Lulu Books, or break pieces off and make them into articles. I mean, when I found out that I had a deal with Random House, I threw up and went to bed for 3 days.
And you got a new roof on your house, did you?
I did. I got a new roof on my house from my advance. And what else did I do? I got new carpeting for the, you know, what we now call the TV room. It was probably used to be called in former days the library.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, in terms of the title, mm-hmm. the title of the book, mm-hmm. Before we get into the title, the cover, who's that on the cover?
Well, a lot of people ask me if that is my mother. And no, that is not my mother. I think that's a stock photo. I mean, I would not put photo of my mother on the front of the book.
Yeah. Did you like the cover? Do you like the picture?
I did, and I'll tell you why. I was really afraid in some of the ideas that I'd heard kicking around the design department. I was really afraid of a kind of ill-informed caricature of an older person. And I don't feel that this is that. This is clearly a dignified person who's goofing around and sort of having a good time.
And the title, it's a Welcome to the Departure Lounge. What's a departure lounge?
Well, commuting between Halifax and New Jersey for about 1 week out of every month, I spent a lot of time in the departure lounge, especially with flight delays that are now so common. And I sat around the departure lounge and I did a lot of writing, note-taking, and I also wrote a lot about the different kinds of things that were going on in my parents' house, partially so that I could kind of leave them behind. You know, I could just get them in that notebook and close it and then go back to my other life. Although, you know, never really quite worked out that way, but I kept hoping. And then it also occurred to me that, you know, we're all in the departure lounge. You know, we just don't really know it.
Well,
and the one time I was taking care of my parents and my brother William called me up to check in and he said, you know, well, how's it going? And I said, well, the drinks are outrageous, and we never run out of nuts. And that just seemed, okay, so clearly it's the departure lounge.
Now, your parents, obviously, they could afford to stay home. But why not a nursing home?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. And just, you know, before we go any further, I want to acknowledge the fact that for most people who are facing the care of their parents, you know, the big burning issue is money. And that was not the case for me, but just about every other problem you can think of, we had. I'm sorry, can you ask me that question again?
Well, why not a nursing home?
Oh, why not a nursing home? Thank you. Well, for one thing, I did not have custody over my mother, and my stepfather's care was not in my hands. It totally was not up to me. And neither parent was interested in living in a nursing home. You know, both of them were a little addle-pated. My stepfather had Alzheimer's disease. My mother had stroke damage and some other complications. And I don't think either one of them could really assess their own situation effectively. But under a court of law, they probably would have held on to their... I probably would not have gained guardianship, at least not in the state of New Jersey. And I was cautioned not to pursue it because if I didn't win, then, you know, I would have ruined my relationship with my mother forever. So I didn't go that route.
How did Addie and Walter meet?
Well, I mean, they'd known each other for a while. They'd sort of been, you know, in the same constellation, social constellation in the town I grew up in. And after Walter's wife died, my father died a long time ago, he and my mother started dating. I think he flat asked her out one time. And I was sitting at my desk at work and the phone rang and it was my mom. And she said to me, "Now, what exactly does one do on a date these days?" And, you know, then she went on to say, "Finally, your extensive experience with men might come in handy." Like, thanks, Mom. I said, "Don't let him kiss you on the first date." What else could I say?
Yeah. Now, were you against the marriage?
I was neither for nor against in the sense that I felt it was my mother's own life and it was up to her to do what she wanted to. I didn't have any control over it. And, you know, she didn't ask me. She didn't say, now, darling, tell me really, what do you think of this? That conversation did not happen. I was told that she was getting married. And when someone tells you they're going to get married and they don't ask you what you think, you have to think twice about saying anything negative. So I didn't. I think that, frankly, I don't know what you accomplish by marrying at age 80 that just doesn't turn into more paperwork. But I also understand that people of her generation, you know, they don't like the optics of just hanging around together. They're more comfortable if they're married.
And I guess you didn't want to have to think about your mom having sex, right?
Well, would you want to think about your mom having sex?
No, not at all.
No, nobody wants to think about that. But I also think that's a part of older life that we don't like to think about for a variety of different reasons. But just because you're 75 doesn't mean you're not still a full-blooded person with the kinds of needs that any human being has. So I think that the rest of us are just being dumb about it, frankly.
Now, what was your relationship with your mother like before all this, before she had the stroke and before all that? Were you unruly growing up?
I was pretty compliant until I became a teenager, and then I just went outrageous. But it was also, you know, the 60s. It was the Civil Rights era. It was the Vietnam War protest era, and it was, you know, the era of pot and LSD and all that stuff. So against that backdrop, yes, I was, you know, completely out of control, but most of us were at that time. And no, I didn't have a good relationship with my mother then. She really ruled with a somewhat humorous, but an iron hand. I mean, you were supposed to be standing in the right place at the right time, wearing the right clothes, and making appropriate comments. And I was the youngest of six, and I wasn't buying into it. So we had a very fractious and contentious relationship while I was, you know, wading through the teen years. And over time, we became more sympathetic to each other, but she still was an overbearing person. And I always felt like I had to dodge that or just be kind of squished under her heel.
Now, after all of this, while you're caring for her and so on,
mm-hmm.
Do you think you understood each other better?
Well, yeah. I mean, I felt that I gained a really... I always wanted my mother's attention, affection, and approval. It wasn't that she wasn't affectionate. She just had a lot of judgment issues. She was constantly... You could never quite measure up, you know, and it was subtle, like the comment might be, "Oh, I like that dress, honey," you know, or, "Oh, I like your hair now." That kind of stuff where you can't quite get at it, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about appearance. It was about any kind of accomplishment. It was always, you know, not quite up to snuff. And I found that was actually much more of a reflection of her own sense of inadequacy that just, you know, she was kind of downloading onto me. One of the gratifying things about being able to be with her at the end of her life was that she was quite, I think because of her dementia, she was actually, her emotions were much more available, and she was kind of simpler. There was less intellectual machinery in place to, you know, thwart your attempts to get in. And I realized how incredibly bad she felt about herself all her life for a variety of reasons. And I like to think I was able to convince her a little bit anyway, otherwise. You know, that she was a good person and she was loved and that she'd had a life worth living.
So this invariably begs a question. Has this changed your own relationship with your children?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I realize quite baldly that they might someday be in charge, and even though I'm sure they don't really think about it, it's there. You know, it's not a hidden issue. It won't come up and be a total surprise for them. But in another way, no, because I've always had a pretty... we have a kind of non-hierarchical family anyway. It's more like a co-op than a family.
Yeah.
And so the kind of rigid structures that... because the kind of rigid structuring that I grew up with just wasn't an issue in our family, and I've always been pretty close to my kids.
Do you have DNR tattooed on your chest?
Not yet, you know, because I just don't feel I'm quite old enough. I'm 53.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm not... Of course, the closer you get, the less... You know, you feel you mean now. You mean I have to do it now.
Yeah.
But I can imagine being afraid to take those kinds of stuff. You know how everybody else sits around and they always say stuff like, oh, if I get like that, take me behind the barn and shoot me?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you feel like that when you're 75 necessarily. I think things look different than they do than when you're 50.
Now, I was wondering, reading the book, how did Walter's family feel about you telling this story?
Well, you know, that's an issue that I've yet to discover more about, and I really tried to not tell their story, but to tell my story. My story of what it looked like to me when I was there. And I spent a lot more time going into my relationship with my mother than trying to say much about what Walter's impact might have been within his own family. Although I did have my own unique relationship with him and got actually quite appreciative of how incredibly difficult it is to be an Alzheimer's victim. Because there's a long period of time where you know things are not right and no explanation serves. Nothing, you know, things don't add up and you're constantly living in that kind of confusion. And I found that really heroic of him to just kind of keep soldiering on. Even though, you know, that we had all the problems that resulted from all the symptoms of Alzheimer's that are so difficult to deal with, but I had a lot of admiration for him, actually.
It just seems to me that he doesn't come off well, neither does his daughter, Kathy.
I wouldn't say that. I would say that I really tried hard to demonstrate that being in a blended family is incredibly difficult, and that Kathy deserved a lot more credit than we were ever really willing to give her. That's really where I was trying to go with that.
What happened to Walter?
He died. He lived in my mother's house for 5 more years, as she had wanted him to. And then he finally did die.
Did you remain close with the family?
With his family?
Yeah.
Not particularly. We weren't all that close to begin with. It's kind of like the kind of thing where you have a project that you work on together and then the project's gone. And I had gone down to New Jersey and visited Walter once. And he had no idea who I was. In fact, he felt as though he was supposed to know who I was, but he didn't. And it was just a disaster. He was unsettled and unhappy, and I felt incredibly weird being in my mother's house where everything was exactly the same except she wasn't there. So, I mean, I kept sending him Christmas cards and cookies and stuff like that, but I never went back to visit him, and the phone was just totally impossible. So, yeah, that unhappily did not continue to be an emotional attachment.
other than Walter and Addie in the book and yourself and your brother and mm-hmm. Kathy, the caregivers, they obviously played an indispensable part to
Absolutely.
The story.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you still keep in touch with some of them?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, if you read earlier in the book, I grew up in this really upstairs-downstairs kind of household.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it was dreadful during the civil rights. I just didn't, my loyalties were so divided. Because I really was raised by a big bunch of older black women. And those are the people I spent most of my time with. Those are the people who took care of me, went to the school play, you know, everything. And yet, at a certain point, I was required to identify with my parents. And I actually thought, when I was a child, that when you got old, you turned black. I just thought that was the continuum of human life. You're
yeah.
born white, and then over time you would turn black.
Yeah.
So, as far as those people went, a lot of them, some of them had been in my life for longer than the situation as it came down when my mother and Walter were married and needed help. I'd known some of those people beyond that situation and did stay in touch with them. The odd thing was, at the same time all this was happening, the person who probably took care of me the very most in my life was in a, she was, you know, in a nursing home in Newark, New Jersey, dying. So there was also her story kind of intertwined with this one, and it was a very different story, but it didn't fit into this book, maybe into another one. But she was very, she always said to me, I'm very happy with my life. I'm very satisfied with who I am and what I've done. And that was in such total contrast to my poor mother, who just suddenly felt like the most unworthy, useless person at the end of her life. And I still try to figure out what, you know, what was the big difference there? What made the difference? I'm not sure what it was.
How did you react? It's almost humorous when your mother would refer to whoever was looking after her at the time as a slave.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
It was absolutely awful. And it was awful on two counts. The first was, you know, the obvious, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just totally horrendous. But the second part was is that I knew in her good mind she didn't mean that. She might have had ideas about, sort of Victorian ideas about class society, you know, upper class and that kind of thing, but she was not a racist person. And that was pretty amazing. But to have her then, you know, sort of reverting to this, I don't even know where it came from. There's mother saying slave, and I just didn't know what part of that of her mind that could have come from. That was quite horrible.
So what advice would you give to someone who's seeking the right caregiver for your parents?
I think that one of the things you have to do when you're looking for a caregiver is to really understand what their daily life is going to be like. And by that I mean, you need to understand that they're coming into a stranger's home and they are working hard with a person that they are not related to, and they're also facing long stretches of boredom. And when you understand that, you begin to understand how a caregiver could maybe not be as attentive as you wish they were, or how a caregiver might run out of gas and just get burnt out and tired of the whole thing. When you're actually screening caregivers, I think you really, really, really have to check references. You've got to do a criminal check, and you've got to do all that stuff, which sounds, I don't know, it sounds somehow as though you don't trust them right off the bat, you know? But it's a line of work that is, there are very low barriers to entry. All different kinds of people can do it, and some people have mixed motives. So you just need to be careful and not get yourself into the position, although I don't know how you avoid it, of just having to take the people who show up. Sometimes we find ourselves on a timeline that we can't avoid. And if you can't stay, you can't be there for your parents, somebody's got to do it, you might find yourself stuck there. But it's way better if you can arrange to take the time to really screen and get the best possible people in the door you can.
Did you ever figure out what happened to your mother's jewelry?
No. That just remains a total mystery.
And
I have no idea.
And how much was lost?
Well, you know, I mean, in the book I put a dollar figure on it. I don't really know
yeah.
the actual dollar value. But let's put it this way, you probably could have gone to graduate school on it.
Really, yeah.
Yeah.
What was the scene at her birthday lunch when you brought her home to die and she gathers you and your siblings and she wants to give you her jewelry?
Well, that was really, you know, when I wrote that, I thought no one will believe this, but it really happened. My mother's jewelry had been stolen, and she had had in particular these three enormous kind of Dame Edna-type gaudy but very expensive rings. And she had always talked about wanting to, you know, give them to her daughters, and there were three of us. And so they were stolen. They weren't in the jewelry box. They weren't there. Mom basically knew they weren't there. But literally just about the day she was dying, she sat up in bed and she said, "Now I'm going to give you, this is the happiest day of my life because I'm going to give you your rings." And my sisters and I looked at each other, you know, whoa, what rings? And then she actually pantomimed and pretended to give us each a ring. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I was just bawling my head off. And, you know, it's the best thing she ever gave me, if that doesn't sound too cliched and too trite, because she really meant it. If those rings had been there, she would have given them to us. And, in fact, even if they weren't there, she was going to give them to us. So that was really quite something.
And you're wearing it now, are you?
Yeah, I never take it off.
Meg, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Congratulations on this book. It's a tremendous one, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks. I really hope that it offers the caregivers out there some fellowship in what is can sometimes feel like a really exasperating and lonely journey.
Indeed, and it's also quite funny, and for that, people should pick it up. The book is called Welcome to the Departure Lounge, Adventures in Mothering Mother, $29.95 from Doubleday. Meg Federico on the line. I'm Joseph Plana.